Blog Talk Radio.
This is Planned Giving Radio. If you're in planned giving, we're in tune with you. If you give us 22 minutes, we will give you the world of planned giving with great interviews with interesting planned giving people from all over North America. I'm Claire Meyerhoff, and my guest is Jack Miller. He's the Director of Gift Planning for the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation, and he's also the principal of Miller Consulting. Welcome to Planned Giving Radio, Jack.
Oh, thank you very much, Claire. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. So let's get to know Jack a little bit better. So it's time for our one-minute resume. So where did you go to college? What was your first real job out of college? And where did you work before Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation?
Well, I'm a Bethany College grad in West Virginia, and I majored in communications and minored in education. My first job was really with the City of Pittsburgh Parks Department. I came out in 1974 in the midst of a recession and started getting some experience writing press releases for the Parks Department, and had a good time doing that, and went on to eventually there become Director of Public Relations for the Pittsburgh Zoo and the Senior Citizens Program.
So you come from nonprofits like the Zoo and the Senior Citizens Program.
Oh, you bet. Yeah.
And then how did you get into fundraising?
It was kind of a situation where I was working at La Roche College here in the region, and I was head of alumni affairs, which is kind of ironic because the college had been predominantly for women entering religious life for nuns. And there had only been, I guess, about three male graduates at the time, and here I was the alumni director, and the development officer suggested it might be wise for me to choose a career path that had more potential for income. Little did he know it was equally low in pay.
Right, just because it has to do with money, people think you make money.
Right, right.
So you were involved with nuns, I understand, and that got you into fundraising. So what was your first real challenge with fundraising? What did you learn on that first fundraising job that you still use today?
I learned that when you're trying to get people to support you, it's really the mission. It's not about getting the gift. It's about getting them excited about what it is you're promoting. And I guess that sort of has a marketing flair to it as well. But it's carried through to this day, and especially with planned giving. You know, when you talk to a donor about a gift, it's got to be something that fits their needs as well as the charities. And never forgotten that. It's carried over well.
And now in your current life, in your current work, do you measure your success by the number of gifts you close each year? How do you know you're doing a good job?
Well, that's usually the result of getting a paycheck that has a signature on it. that's the ultimate test. But I would say, you know, usually you establish mutually agreeable goals with your employer. And over the course of the year, hopefully you're discussing those. And if you're on target, everything's fine. And if you're not, there's usually reasons why you're not, and you have to adapt to those. So I would say that it's really understanding where you are as an organization, how you fit into the strategic plan from your departmental area, and then trying to stay on track relative to the number of leads you want to identify and the number of dollars you want to bring in.
So do you keep track then? Do you keep meticulous records then of your visits that you make and things like that? Is that one way you kind of measure how well you're doing?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's different. On the one hand, where you do consultancy work, it's really word-of-mouth referrals. Where you're dealing directly with a nonprofit organization, every person that you see, you need to understand where they are right now, because as you visit them and talk to them in the future, their circumstances change, and you want to know how it changes in relationship to you. And without having those meticulous records, you really can't keep track of that.
So do you think that would be some good advice for someone who is very new to planned giving, that maybe they don't have much direction, all of a sudden they're in this job and they don't have a lot of direction? If you were to give them some advice, would it be something along those lines?
Well, I have some things that I would, you know, and I do meet with new development officers, new plan giving officers. You know, I sort of call it like being in the know, Know the capacity of your prospects. I mean, don't waste time seeking a planned gift from somebody who doesn't have the resources to make a large gift. And know your donor profiles. Like, in other words, who's most likely to be a donor? You may think it's the person who gives you $100,000 a year, but you may get that one time. The largest bequests and planned gifts come from childless, single women over the age of 75 who make regular, smaller gifts to your organization over a long period of time. It's really more about frequency. So that's important. And I would say know that your prospects' priorities are your priorities. In other words, you're not going to get a gift if it means your donor's prospects aren't going to get braces for their kids, or there's not going to be a family vacation, or they're going to miss a mortgage payment to make your gift. You know, but that said, I like to say to folks, if I can show you a way to redirect your taxes to your family, your community, and our mission, will you give me a half an hour to discuss the matter with you? And usually they will do that. So those are some of them. Now, there's some other ones, like knowing the difference between rejection and opportunity. That's very important, and particularly newer development officers, planned giving officers, when they hear a no, a lot of times they take it personally. But when you get a no but, that's what I call a qualifier, a no but is an opportunity to get a large gift down the line, because if you can address the objection that somebody is raising about your organization, no, I'm not going to make a gift, but if you do something differently, I might consider it. If you do consider it and eventually those changes are made, the prospect knows that you care about their opinion and you care enough to do something different to improve the organization. So we have to be sensitive to those kinds of things. And then ultimately, and you touched on this earlier, you know, you have to know how to prioritize your time. And call reports help you do that. But focus on the best prospects first. Put together a ranking of your top 100 leads and review it regularly and, you know, track progress through those call reports. And do a weekly report, which is something that I've done for about 20 years to keep me organized. You know, who am I going to see? What were the results? Just a one-sheet page that you can come back to. And then finally, know that assets are more expendable than cash for your prospects, and they carry more tax benefits. If you, you know, need a new program site, for instance, ask for the building. Don't ask for the cash to buy one, and be willing to think outside the box. Those are sort of the big things that I really try to push newer people in the field to think about.
So when you say 100 prospects, is that kind of a general number for a certain size institution, or does that kind of work for everybody, that 100? Is that a magic number?
It's a nice number because your boss will like the fact that it's three digits. But I would tell you that depending upon how you qualify those prospects, let's say, for instance, that each of them is a potential $1 million donor. I think you can't devote the amount of time that you need to for 100 prospects. You might have maybe 25 people that you're looking at. You do have to take into account the amount of time needed to realize a gift and the level of gift that you're looking for. This all comes into assessing with your supervisor, your boss, what you need and what the best way to approach it is. I might say, you know, it makes sense for us to hire two additional staff people to address this group of 100 if I'm going to show a $40 million return. Those are sort of the ways you have to look at it.
And how often do you meet with your supervisor and have these meetings concerning your strategy and who you're going to reach out to?
It varies from employer to employer, but with my current employer, I have a great relationship, and because I do these weekly reports, he knows where I am every Friday afternoon in terms of who I've seen, where we are, and he gets a copy of the confidential call reports. He's not somebody who looks over my shoulder. He knows if I have a problem, I'll raise the question probably initially in the weekly report, but if I have a particular problem or need him to do something to help me close a gift with a special prospect, I can set up the time and go in and see him. But I would say, generally speaking, we maybe meet four times a year with a scheduled time to go over things, unless he needs to see me based on something I have in the weekly report.
Speaking of colleagues and your other colleagues that you work with, how do you keep them apprised of what's going on in planned giving? How do you get them excited about planned giving when maybe it's not really their cup of tea, or they're not very well educated about it, or they just don't have the time to even think about it or care about it? What do you do to help your colleagues become excited about planned giving?
Are you talking about the ones on staff or the ones in the profession?
Ones on staff, the people that you work with that maybe are also in development, or depending on the size of an organization, it might be the communications director at your organization, or the director if they don't have much interaction with you.
Well, I would have to be totally fair and give credit to probably the first three gifts that I got for our organization here at Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation to our support staff. My favorite story is we had a staff meeting. I was relatively new, 3 weeks with the organization, and boss introduced me, and great staff, a lot of seniority, people stay here. And my message to them was basically, right now, you know that people are going to make large gifts to this organization better than I do. It's all about relationships. So you're going to have questions that arise like, wow, I really like what you're doing on this project, and I wish I could help, but I want to leave things to my children, and I don't have the money to do that. Or I'd really like to make a gift now, but I have it all tied up in stock, and I'll have to pay a capital gains tax if I sell it. Just sort of tipping the staff off to the kinds of things they would hear about as objections, you know, a no but, kinds of lead for me. And I said, when you hear these things, you need to know, for me, they're important, and you need to tip me off to them. And the first major gift that I got here for Landmarks was a retained life estate gift, and our maintenance and property supervisor was putting a historic plaque on a building in Pittsburgh, and the owner, who was a single woman with no children over the age of 65, said to him, put that on straight, because someday you're going to get this house. And Tom was smart enough to recognize this sounds like something Jack was talking about. So he got in his truck and drove around the block and called me from his cell phone and said, Jack, I think this is what you were talking about. I said, absolutely was. Ask her if she would be willing to meet with me for a couple minutes. I'd call her in a few days. You know, not a rush situation. We don't want to be too eager. And that led to a retained life estate gift, because the owner had already put us in her will to receive that house, but she wasn't getting any benefits from that. And now, in addition to that staff person putting that lead in direct contact with me, we've helped that person make a gift of the house, get a tax deduction, take money out of an IRA that became non-taxable because there was an offsetting deduction, and she's now volunteering at our organization. So it's the perfect kind of situation. And then I have other people who tip me off to so-and-so mentioned that their children are having trouble with this or that, and they'd like to find a way to handle funds, and how can they secure their own income in light of the economy. I've gotten two or three gift annuities from people who told our volunteers while they were here that, you know, Jack has these silly things, I can't explain them, but if you need income, you need to talk to him, because you can help us and Landmarks at the same time. And we get excited about our mission, and we get more excited when we help our donors and friends support it in a way that helps them. And that's really, you know, what I try to encourage, not just staff people, but our colleagues in the field, more general fundraisers as opposed to planned giving fundraisers. And we interact a lot with them. So
yes,
there are just so many opportunities because staffs have relationships.
I really like what you said about the person that says, well, Jack's got these silly things that I don't really know about. And I think that's good for people to hear, because a lot of times people, let's say you're a volunteer at an organization, you don't like to talk about something if you don't know a lot about it. You want to seem like at least somewhat of an expert or speak intelligently about it. But I think it addresses the idea that you don't have to be an expert on planned giving vehicles, as long as you get the general idea and then know who to refer the person to. And I think that that's an excellent point that you make.
Planned gifts are solutions to problems. That's really what they are. They're not gifts. They're ways to help people achieve their personal objectives which include supporting organizations they care about. To me, it's a great joy to come to work every day. And I have people say to me, how can you ask people for money? I could never do that, you know. And they don't get it. We don't ask people to give us money. We ask people to support important missions. Money sometimes is a way to do it. Real estate sometimes is a way to do it. Tangible property sometimes is a way to do it. But if they want to help, we can show them how to do it. And that's kind of what's exciting.
Now, since your donors are interested in land and buildings and historic preservation and that whole area, let's talk a little bit about real estate and planned gifts, because I know that's something you know quite a bit about.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything specific you would like to know?
Well, I guess what I'd like to know is what is the good trend right now that other people in the field, other planned giving people, what they should need to know that might not be quite on their radar screen because that's not what they deal with so much. But since you deal with real estate as your organization's mission, maybe there's some things you know that you'd like to share.
Well, the first one would be that we as development officers should recognize that cash is the worst gift an individual can make from their standpoint, because cash is liquid and it pays the bills. The best asset to give is something that has appreciated in value and is illiquid, because by giving it away, you can realize a benefit. You can either, you know, realize a significant tax benefit and avoid capital gains taxes. You can even, you know, let's take a house, for instance. You can give a charity an immediate interest in a house through a retained life estate gift, which creates a charitable deduction, which then you can roll money out of a traditional IRA to offset the tax. That's just one little plan. Maybe you have a property that hasn't been selling because of the financial markets, and I as a charity happen to have a need for that building. I need some cash, but I don't need as much cash as I was going to sell it for. I can sell it for less than its value and get a deduction for the difference using a fair market value appraisal, and get a deduction and help the charity and help myself at the same time, really getting rid of the aggravation of having to sell the property too. We have our warehouse here because a couple who was older was looking to retire, and they were in the pizza manufacturing business as opposed to just your little pizza stores around
right.
the corner. They manufactured crust and pizzas for suppliers and for the city school system here and for parochial schools. And, you know, the big boys, the big companies were cornering that market, and they wanted to sell the business that they had started to somebody who cared about it just as much as they did. But you know what? Nobody cares just as much about it as the people who started. So his health was deteriorating, and the long and short of this is another employee who was working on identifying warehouse space for us mentioned to him, hey, we have this guy who might be able to show you a way to get income for the rest of your life instead of a lump sum. Would you be willing to consider that versus us having to pay you $100,000 for the building? And at that point, they said yes. 2 weeks ago, I was in Florida, was visiting with them. They're getting quarterly checks for the rest of their lives. The building is gone. His health has never been better. He doesn't have the stress of the building and business anymore. And we're no longer paying $10,000 a year for space to house our historic artifacts. So there's a classic case where somebody has an asset, they can give you it and return and receive a lifetime income in return. So that's another case. We had another person put a historic farm into a charitable remainder trust. And these are great stories. I'm sorry if I get rolling here. But my boss, I was here maybe a year, and he comes in and hands me a letter, and it's from an 80-year-old woman who says, Arthur, if you know somebody who will buy my farm and not develop it, please let me know, because I don't want the developers around here dividing up the 70 acres and putting $500,000 houses on it. My boss comes in and says, I think this is why we hired you. This is his line. I go out and meet with a woman. She's on a tractor, 80 years old, and she says, I think God sent you to me. Talk about pressure. You know, I think God sent you to me. Well, the long and short of it is a year and a half later, her farm was put in a charitable trust. We put a preservation easement on it. We bought the farm and resold it, restricted, lost $200,000 because the farm couldn't be developed. But she made us the irrevocable sole beneficiary of the trust, which means after 20 years, when she's received her payments from the proceeds of the sale of the farm, we get what's left. And guess what? It more than makes up for the money we lost in selling the farm with the restrictions on it. So we did our mission. We converted the farm. We addressed her preservation mission. And everybody's happy. And right now it's the only 60-acre green space area in a developing northern Allegheny County here. I mean, it's what makes it fun to come to work every day.
And it's such a creative solution. Here's this one property. It's just one single property, but look at all the benefits that it reaped for all these different people. Everybody's happy, it seems like, because of this one creative solution.
Well, the developers aren't, but they
have plenty
of other stuff that they're getting a hold of, and we're doing our little bit, and people are seeing that one person can make a difference. And you know what's exciting for me is before, when I worked at United Way, we would accept stock gifts, and they were nice gifts, and it supported the mission. But I never felt like I was really part of the mission. The gifts I've accepted here, a lot of them historic farms, the fund plan gifts, bargain sale gifts, have not only saved things that would have been lost otherwise, but helped stimulate historic development around it. So, you know, it's like I'm actually playing a role in preserving the history of the city I love. It's very satisfying to me. I mean, I had never been in a place more than 3 years in my 30 years of development. I'm starting my 11th year here. So it's just, this is what philanthropy can be if everybody knows what the possibilities are. You don't have to be the expert. I'm not an attorney, and I'm not a CPA. The staff likes to say I'm no ordinary dummy either, but we get the job done. If somebody has a concern about our mission, they get sent over to me, and I spend some time with them, and if there's a way to do something, I will. And preservation easements are a beautiful way to create deductions, still keep people in control of their property so they can sell it when they're gone, but yet they can get a deduction for it now and do things with the cash that frees up for them. It's just an exciting profession, and for those young people who are getting started in it, it's really how you can make a change in our world. It's special.
There's a gift that you just mentioned, and the name of it, is it a yard sale gift? What is it? What did you just? It's where you the donor sells a property for less value, and then the organization.
Bargain sale.
Bargain sale. Yeah,
charitable bargain sale. Right.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, let's say you have a house, a vacation home, and you're no longer using it, and you want to sell it, and the market's down, and it's in Hilton Head, South Carolina. You want to get some cash out, but you can't get what it's really worth. So you figure, well, I want to help the Pittsburgh History Landmarks Foundation, or I want to help my local hospital or school. I'm going to ask them if they'll buy it from me for $250,000 instead of $500,000. And the charity will explore that because we have gift acceptance policies that our boards approve, say, okay, we will or we won't take real estate, we will or we won't take it in other cities, we will or we won't do this or that. But let's assume it's something that the charity sees as something it can use in one way, shape, or form, or can sell and realize the difference. What happens is the charity will buy it for $250,000. Maybe it waits a year or two till the market turns around and it sells it for $500,000. And what happens is you've in effect gotten your $250,000 and you got a charitable deduction for the difference between what the house was valued at the time you gave it to the charity and what was paid for it by the charity. So you're using a charitable deduction to help enhance the deal. And then the charity then uses all of the proceeds from the eventual sale to promote its mission, or it uses the property itself for its mission. Maybe it puts doctor's offices in there if it's a hospital, or as we did in our case, we used the building as a warehouse for our historic artifacts.
And that's in this day and age too. That's a perfect solution for a lot of people. Say you have a loyal donor, and they have a condo somewhere, and it's a third home or a second home, and mm-hmm. and they hardly use it anymore, and it just sits there, and the market is terrible for selling it. And this would be a great way for that loyal donor to get rid of the condo, get some money out of it, get the tax benefit, and also give a gift to their favorite organization.
That's absolutely correct. You should be a planned giving person.
Well, maybe in my next career, I'm trying to learn as much as I can about planned giving. It's such an interesting field, and here on Planned Giving Radio, I get to talk to all kinds of great people like you that know so much about the field. So here's my last question to you. What is the strangest gift that you have ever accepted?
The strangest gift I've ever accepted. Well, I would say it's a toss-up between two. There was an outright gift of a house that the donors rented back from the charity at competitive rates, you know, which is not the same as a retained life estate gift, and there are some issues with the IRS that you got to be careful of, but they paid fair market rent to get it back to use it. And the other one was the gift of a funeral home to fund a charitable remainder annuity trust. So both of those were very technical and involved quite a bit of work, but I guess I'd have to give it to the funeral home deal since it was a precedent setter in Pennsylvania and kind of scary to set up and even scarier to think about.
So they gave the funeral home? How did that work?
Well,
you would think those remain in families forever.
And when we say charitable remainder trust, we're not kidding. But if you can envision a jar, okay, with a lid.
Yes.
And you put the funeral home and all of its assets inside the jar and put the lid on, okay? And then once the lid's on, it's a separate tax entity. The XYZ charity is the beneficiary of that trust, and the income that's generated goes back to the donor for a period of time. So what slips through the lid of that jar is the income that's generated from the assets inside. So the funeral home, the business, and its assets could be sold by the trust with no tax consequences because the trust is a charity. So the income is taxed coming out to the donor. But whenever the trust ends, whatever's left goes back to the charity in that case. And this particular donor chose to have fixed income for a period of 15 years. He was relatively young, so he was able to dispose of the business. Nobody in his family wanted to continue running it. It had a very low-cost basis, so he would have had significant capital gains. The funeral home was, you know, in effect, put out there in the market to the highest buyer, highest bidder, and it was a $4 million deal, which ultimately will net the charity. That's just about two more years to run on that one. I would say would net them about $1 million. So it was a win-win. And it was really driven by family circumstances. And the irony is the funeral home owner had donated to the place where I worked, which dealt with the elderly, sort of a nursing home life complex, cemetery plots, and did burials for indigent patients. So there was a relationship there, too, which was very nice. So you don't just go out and do these things. It's like always be aware of the person who comes to you on December 28th with a gift of real estate that coincidentally used to be a gas station. Don't take that.
So always pay attention to everything that's going on. I think it helps that your background is in communications and journalism because you have an eye for a good story, and it seems like a lot of situations in planned giving come from a good story.
My closest advisor, my wife, likes to affectionately say, I have a BA in BS.
I think that's a great note to end on, the BA in BS. So I'd like to thank you, Jack Miller, for coming today. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's Jack Miller from the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation, also the principal at Miller Consulting. You can learn more about Jack at www.jackoutsidethebox.net. That's jackoutsidethebox.net. And you can find us on plangivingradio.com and on Facebook. I'm Claire Meyerhoff, and thanks for listening to Plan Giving Radio.